The belief that the British have betrayed the Iranians is founded on the fact that their expectations of Britain were higher. Do you see what I mean? I mean, the betrayal is predicated on the fact that in some way they considered each other friends and they felt they were let down by the British, but it's because there was something that the British could let them down over. Nobody felt betrayed by the Russians because nobody actually assumed the Russians were going to do anything. I mean, so there is that element there, which I think is very interesting. It sort of partly explains, by the way, that despite, as you say, your relatives or any Iranian you talk to will tell you, the British do this, the British do that. At the end of the day, the number one destination for many of these people whinging about, whatever Britain is, Britain. There are very few Iranians I know who want to go to Russia, ever. I mean, not just now. I mean, ever. Nobody wants to go to Russia.
Hello and welcome to the pod. Iran and Britain have had a long and complex relationship, but one built on mutual admiration. In my case, I've admired the Persian Empire through the prism of the Greeks and Alexander the Great, but then later I fell in love with a real live Iranian girl with whom I'm now married. So when I learnt that Ali Ansari, director of the Institute of Iranian Studies at St Andrews University, had written a short history of Iran, I was desperate to chat. And our discussion very much focuses on the relationship between the two countries, from the Constitutional Revolution of 1906 up to the coup of 1953. Anyway, please do get in touch. There are links in my email is in the show notes, history@aspectsofhistory.com. So do contact me with any comments. Please share with friends and family. There's plenty more great history to come. In the meantime, I'll hand you over to Ali Ansari and myself on Iran and Britain. Ali Ansari, welcome. Thank you very much for joining me. It's a great honor for me to have you on. Huge fan.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And we're here to talk about you've got a new book, and it's a kind of a pocket book.
It is. It's meant to be taken on the road, I think.
Well, I've been taking it in my pocket, so it certainly works. It's a very beautiful cover, actually.
Well, I have to say, I'm glad you said that because I'm particularly pleased with the cover. And I think it's one of the few times when actually my choice of cover has been accepted by the publisher. So I was pretty pleased by that. And it's very bold, isn't it? They've done it in quite a nice way.
Very much so. Very much so. Yes, it's part of a series, but I have to admit this is the one in the series that I'm most interested in. So, just before we started recording, for the benefit of listeners, we talked about what we're going to talk about today, and it's not going to be a history of Iran in less than an hour. It's far too much to cover, and the book itself is a really great introduction, I would say, to anyone who's got even the slightest interest in Iran in the 20th century. And we're going to talk about Iran's relationship with Britain, and in particular the coup in 53 today, but I don't want to start in sort of 1950 or 51. And as you make very clear in the book, throughout actually, one thing that we should all understand is the constitutional revolution that Iran underwent in the early part of the 20th century. And so I wondered if it would be possible to start off, just for the benefit of listeners who maybe aren't familiar with the constitutional revolution, and there may be many, exactly how important that is in the development of Iran's. Well, it's constitution, of course, but it's.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think the Constitutional Revolution, in many ways, is the most significant political revolution that's taken place in Iran in the 20th century. And I think, in its longer-term consequences, will be far more significant than the Islamic Revolution. I mean, the Islamic Revolution of 1979 has the advantage of being proximate, and we're obviously living with the immediate consequences, so it seems far more important. But I think if you're taking the long perspective, I think people would say, certainly I would say, the Constitutional Revolution has had a much more profound impact. And not only did it introduce the country to constitutionalism and a parliamentary system of democracy, although I use that term loosely, it also really embedded the ideology of nationalism within the country, which we're living with to this day, by the way, and set the template really for political activity for, well, ever since. And of course, when you look at 53 and you look at Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, the prime minister during the oil nationalization crisis, of course, he's a hangover from the constitutional period. I mean, he was quite old when he became prime minister, but it was a sort of a very active young man in the sort of the height of the Constitutional Revolution and participated, and that's what really shaped him. So it's very difficult to understand, you know, many of the things that happen afterwards if you don't realise, you know, who was it? I think it's Napoleon, isn't it, who said that if you want to understand a man, you have to look at his worldview when he was 21. Well, I mean, this is the sort of thing, you know. A lot of these politicians in the 40s and 50s were shaped by the Constitutional Revolution. This was the thing that formed their political ideas. So I think without having an understanding of that, it's very difficult to know, you know, what motivated them going forward. And of course, Mossadegh has been described really as an anti-imperialist and, you know, someone who brought the British Empire to an end in Iran. I actually think, you know, when I look at it, that he might find that depiction of himself a little bit simplistic. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily wrong, but tad simplistic. I think he would have seen himself. I mean, he was a lawyer by training. He would have seen himself as really a product of the Constitution, a constitutionalist, and that's what his ambitions were. The nationalisation of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company was really a means to an end. It wasn't an end in itself.
He's not in any way a nationalist, even though that's what he would be viewed by some from the actions of 53.
I think he was a nationalist, and I think, but of course, nationalism has a range of meanings, you know. I mean, this is the problem. I think in the same way as sort of like what we might term a sort of a liberal nationalism, even a cosmopolitan nationalism that was introduced really into the body politic from 1906 onwards, I think Mossadegh is very much in some ways a reflection of that. Now, of course, you know, in some elements of it, he might have imbued or digested some elements which we might term quite radical or revolutionary in some ways. But I think at heart, he wasn't. I think at heart, he was a constitutionalist, and a constitutionalist who, you know, was a patriot. I mean, if we take the distinctions that George Orwell uses, you know, he tries to distinguish between patriots and nationalists. He was probably, you know, what you could say a patriot rather than nationalist. But I think in his own frame of mind, he would have seen himself. I mean, remember, you know, that the movement he ostensibly led was the National Front. You know, Jebhe Milli was the National Front. So that's the way they would have viewed things.
And so during the Constitutional Revolution, then, this is understanding of the time period. This is a kind of 8-year period, really, where I mean, 1906 is a key year, but this is a revolution that's over a number of years as things change.
It is. Well, I mean, the critical date is 1906. Is 1906 is when you get the agreement to establish a sort of a constitutional system and a parliament. But of course, it has a very long roots, very deep roots in the 19th century, and it has a very long tail. You know, so is that the right way of saying it, actually? Is it wrong roots and tail? I think so. I mean, it casts a long shadow, let me put it that way. And it took several years. I mean, you know, what you have is the establishment of a constitution and a parliament. But of course, then you get, you know, infighting, civil disturbances, even a civil war, and reaction against the parliament, the new king who comes in. The king who granted the constitution, of course, had the good fortune to die after he signed the constitution. So, but then his successor, his son, had no interest in that. And the Russians were not keen on any sort of constitutional settlement, so they agitated against it. And the fundamental problem with the constitutional movement is it was high on aspiration, but not very good at the practicalities. So, you know, you had all these people rushing to attend parliament in Tehran, you know, with wonderful, wonderful ideas, very progressive ideas, what to do, you know, free education, you know, a central bank, a judicial system, all sorts of things like that. And then, but nobody had any idea how you're going to achieve these things. So, I mean, the problem with the constitutional revolution in Iran is it effectively anticipated the creation of the modern state. It didn't follow, you know, you didn't have a functioning state in the way we would understand it, you know, beyond basically the court and the household, which you then delimit. Basically, they set up this sort of like constitutional system and then said, right, well, let's go and start having free education for everyone. And someone says, well, who's going to pay for it? And they go, oh, well, that's an interesting idea. Well, I suppose we might tax people. And they go, well, who's going to collect the taxes? I mean, it was that basic. Do you know what I mean? I mean, there was no functioning system of government as we would understand it, which is why the system basically stutters to a halt. The revolution stutters to a halt. You get into the Great War, and then, you know, after the Great War, in sheer desperation in many ways, many of the intellectuals come to the conclusion that what Iran actually needs is an enlightened despot. And the critical term here is enlightened despot. I mean, you know, because enlightened despots are good things. And looking at European history, they realized that, you know, they were in such a bad way that really what they needed was a sort of an Iranian Peter the Great. And they say this very explicitly. I mean, they say that's what we need. And of course, you know, the person who ends up fulfilling that role, ironically enough, is the Persian commander of the Cossack Brigade, a Russian unit that, because of the Russian Revolution, basically was devoid of Russian officers. They'd all either been sacked or went home or whatever. And therefore, the more junior officers took over, you see. So, and then he comes in and is the sort of the armed wing of a coup in 1921, Reza Khan, this is. And he ultimately establishes the Pahlavi dynasty in 1925.
The ideas behind the constitutional revolution, which obviously continue strongly throughout the century, is another reason why they're perhaps not as filtered down is that it's based in Tehran. How much do we see in sort of Isfahan and other cities around Iran?
Well, it's a very interesting question, because basically the two focal points of the constitutional revolution are Tehran and Tabriz. And Tabriz is important because it's at the northwest corner of Iran. It's the most in touch, effectively, in terms of connections with the Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire. So it has international connections. But then as the revolution proceeds, you do get sort of developments in Mashhad, Isfahan, Shiraz, and other places where it becomes quite active. But certainly in terms of the politically active class, Tehran and Tabriz are the two main centers. And what you have to remember as well, I think, is that the politically active class in Iran is very small in this period, by the way. I mean, we're not talking, it's not like people talk about a mass movement. I mean, you've got to qualify that. Now, this has led a number of historians unsympathetic to the movement to dismiss it as, you know, sort of an elite fantasy. But, you know, actually, when you're looking at political change in any country, you always need a vanguard. You know, you need a group that are going to drive it forward. And in Iran, this is the group. Now, the problem is they were so far ahead, you know, of everyone else, that basically when they actually won, you know, and got there, they realized that, you know, blimey, we have no hinterland here to draw on. And this again, is the problem, which is why at the end of the Great War, you see a number of intellectuals saying that what we really need is someone to come and build the state. Then we can think about, you know, parliamentary democracy afterwards. But it's a, you know, in terms of a functioning state, this is what is effectively built and put into place between 1924 and 36 or 37.
Reading the book and trying to understand the elements that make up Iranian society is interesting to me, because it's so key. You know, you read about it today with protests, but I was keen to understand what those elements are. So I know the bazaar is very important, market holders and people who are connected to that industry, the countryside dwellers and towns and in the countryside. What other parts constitute the sort of the Iranian society and how they view the constitutional revolution?
So, I mean, you can, you know, I basically say that really, you know, Iranian society can be divided between the rulers and those who are ruled. Okay. I mean, you know, the idea that you have different classes and stuff in terms of a hierarchy of classes, it doesn't really work, because there's no real middle class in that sense. But among, you know, those who are, how should we say, I mean, to coin a phrase, owners of the means of production, if you want to put it that way, you know, sort of, you have, you know, elements of the clergy, certainly the senior clergy, these Shia ulama, you know, the mullahs and so on. You have the bazaaris, and these can range again from those who are very wealthy bazaaris, those who are the traders, the merchants, and those who are lesser so. Then you have landowners, and you can add to that, you know, I suppose, intellectuals as well, those who are, you know, a very small group of very active intellectuals and revolutionaries. Now, of course, one of the problems in this sort of classification is we tend to make these categories sort of into neat and tidy categories, you know. And of course, that just doesn't work. Not only do you see a lot of sort of bleeding into each category. I mean, you know, you can, some mullahs would be involved in trade, and then there'd be landowners who are intellectuals, and some intellectuals would be obviously come from the clerical class, you know, I mean, all a very broad range. Not only is there a lot of bleeding into each group, but the other thing is also the groups themselves are quite divided. I mean, you know, there's this view that, you know, these are sort of homogenous groups that all gather together and mount a challenge to the king. The fact is, actually, you know, even under the clergy, within the clergy, there was quite severe divisions among them. I mean, there was a very famous cleric, Fazlullah Nuri, who was eventually hanged in 1909, who opposed the constitutional revolution vehemently. I mean, he sort of claimed that, you know, this was un-Islamic and, you know, you can't have any restrictions on the monarch. But there were also a great number of very senior clerics who were very supportive of the constitutional revolution. I mean, this is the interesting thing. And one of the problems we have is we actually haven't done enough work on the sort of things they were doing, where they justified constitutionalism on Islamic grounds. You know, the Barzaris and to some extent the landowners had their own grievances. They didn't always necessarily understand what was meant by a parliament, what was meant by, you know, constitutionalism. But nonetheless, you know, they coalesced around this this mission, this goal. And, you know, the fascinating thing that is in 90, when the parliament first sat in 1906, and again, it was a telltale sign of things to come that the parliament was heavily weighted in favor of deputies from Tehran, which didn't play very well, of course, you see, because, you know, essentially you got all these deputies in Tehran taking up their seats while everyone else was still busy traveling from around the countryside. And then, you know, starting the process without waiting for it. They said, well, Corey, let's get on with it, which was, you know, not a great way to start, I have to say. But what's fascinating is that one of the leading lights of the constitutional movement, a gentleman who's very influential in the creation of a modern Iranian identity, I have to say, a gentleman by the name of Mohammad Ali Furughi. And Furughi and his father had been pivotal in the establishment of the first school of political science, law and political science in Iran in 1899. He was very, very well-read in Western philosophy. And he actually develops his handbook. I mean, it's a glorious thing. A handbook of what a deputy, what are the responsibilities of a parliamentary deputy? You know, what is your function? What do you do? And it lists beautifully, and it goes through the French system, the British system, the notes of right, the idea of rights, what you do when you vote for legislation, you know, the very, very basic, it's almost like a handbook of, you know, what you do. And in many ways, it's very emblematic of the dynamic, if somewhat, I don't want to say naive, but, you know, people were learning on the move, you know, learning on the hoof. And while there were a number of people who really understood what was going on, there were a lot of people who were really, you know, picking things up as they went along. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like you had a ready waiting. It's not like the French Revolution, for instance, or anything like that. I mean, it's not like you had a ready, you know, a core of people who were all well-versed in Voltaire and Rousseau and whatever and ready to get going. Quite a few of them had to read up pretty quickly on what this whole business was about.
Yeah, there's no guiding hand. I mean, I don't want that to sound in any way condescending, but there's no kind of guiding hand. Like the monarch can't provide a guiding hand in this.
No, not at all. I mean, it's very against the monarch, of course. So, but for me, the Constitutional Revolution is a good example, I have to say, an excellent example, even if you will, of the power of ideas. Because these ideas had been gestating and swirling around in the Iranian body politic, I mean, the literate Iranian body politic, a very limited group, but really for decades. And it'd been discussed and debated and, you know, regurgitated and so on and so forth. It was simply a question of really building up the momentum towards, you know, this opportunity, this challenge of a constitutional settlement in 1906. And, you know, I think the intellectuals played a pivotal role in being able to disseminate those ideas and getting them out there. And a very effective one. I mean, I think they were very effective. And the effectiveness of this is really, as I said, expressed by the fact that even though in an immediate sense, it wasn't a success. I mean, it was far from a success. The fact is that the ideas around it have just stuck and people keep aspiring to it. So no regime in Iran from 1906 to the current now, you know, in the 1st of March, we're about to have the next parliamentary elections in Iran. Now, nobody's going to vote in these elections. I mean, this, because, you know, basically every government has sought to manipulate or, you know, rig it and this, that, and the other. And so they've never really it's never really functioned as it should. The Islamic Republic now is rigging it on a massive scale to the point that actually nobody's interested anymore. But nobody has dared abolish it. I mean, this is the thing. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, so Khomeini didn't come in and go, right, we're tearing all this up.
No, they all think it's an absolutely essential and pivotal. Now, they renamed it after the revolution, of course. It was the National Consultative Assembly, and then it became the Islamic Consultative Assembly. But to all intents and purposes, it was the same thing.
So we move from the Qajar dynasty then, as you've mentioned, the Pahlavis take over under Reza Shah. And then I was interested in, you know, there's always been a foreign involvement, particularly Russia and Britain in Iran, and then increasingly America, particularly after the war, the Second World War. And this is where, you know, we get towards 53. And I know I'm, you know, there's many years I'm skipping over here, But the interest that Britain has is sort of, it's always in opposition to Russia and their interest in Iran. Is there a point where, because I speak to a lot of Iranians. I'm married. My wife, her parents are both Iranian. She's born here, but my father-in-law lives in Isfahan. I have listeners in Iran.
Excellent.
Yes. So the first thing, or one of the first things an Iranian will say to me when I meet them is, oh, you British, you're always involved in Iran. You're always meddling in Iran, which is true. But it's not as simple as, you know, Britain wanting to completely... Okay, there is obviously the Anglo-Iranian oil company that is the big player here. But do you think Iranians slightly misrepresent the British involvement in Iran?
I think your own conjecture of yes, but is right. Because I think there's a popular mythology, and popular mythology is always painted in primary colours, and people absorb these. And the British were always seen as... The interesting thing about the British and the British role in Iran is you have to remember that the British come to Iran from India. And because they come to Iran from India, India is also part of the Persianate world in this period. Remember, I mean, when the British are moving into India in the 18th and 19th centuries, you know, the language of government in India is Persian. Okay? So their entire world is essentially Persian. I mean, the Mughal Empire was run on, you know, on principles that were really derived from the Persian administrative manuals and the language everyone used, you know, until 1857, until the end of the mutiny or the rebellion or whichever you want, however you want to call it. You know, Persian was essentially seen as the language of government, and then they moved to English. I mean, of course, Macaulay institutes reforms earlier. But my point is that the British who travelled to Iran in the early part of the 19th century mainly come from India. And they come from India, and they're well-versed in Persian idioms and ideas and culture and how to talk and this sort of thing. And because the British also are relatively poor, I don't say that in absolute terms. I mean, relatively, I mean, and also a little bit tight, you know, in terms of expenditure. You say, I always say, and I say this to my students, you know, the Russians on the threat on the northern border, and let's not have any illusions about this. The Russians are the most serious political and military threat to Iran in the 19th century. I mean, it's without a shadow of doubt. And it's very simple, because there's a border on the north and the Russians can move troops easily. It's cheap for them. The British, on the other hand, are a naval power, essentially. And what they don't want to do is they don't want to go around shifting troops here and there. And they're very, very, you know, not keen on that. So what they do, they compensate for that, really, by developing a very, very highly sort of sophisticated, educated diplomatic corps, if you want to call it that, of basically political officers. And these political officers are often very multilingual. You know, they speak multiple languages, obviously, but it's more than just speaking languages. As I say to colleagues here, I say, it's not a question of ordering tea. It's a question of how you order tea. You know, I mean, this is the thing. So they know all the nuances.
They understand Tarov.
Yes. No, they've got it all. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they know. Yeah. I mean, the level
for the benefit of listeners, that's when someone offers you something and you say, you have to say no a number of times before you
but
say
you really mean yes. Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Or for those you go to Tehran and the taxi driver says, you know, be my guest. He doesn't really mean it. Pay him. Yeah. So it's that sort of thing. But, you know, the there's some wonderful accounts of British diplomats in Iran in the first half of the 19th century. And they know exactly what they're up to. And there are two things that the British have that the Iranians are impressed with. One is that the British have a tremendous soft power pull for the Iranians. They're not Russia. They're not the autocracy from the north. And they sell Iran this idea of Whiggish progress, okay? And they sort of say to the Iranians, you can do what we did. You know, we're a miserable island on the northwest coast of Europe, but look how successful we are. And we've done it because we've got education, rule of law, this sort of thing. So they do that. And that's very attractive to Iranians. I mean, Iranians like that. And naturally, because, you know, what the British are saying is, it's, your problems are political. Your problems are not to do with your social makeup. It's not because you're Iranians. It's because your political system is wrong, you know, which is fine. You know, people can... But the other thing is that they are very good, because they have to use political officers and diplomacy and a little bit of wiliness, whatever. They sort of outdo the Persians, the Iranians, in terms of political, playing the political game. And the Iranians actually find that quite impressive. I mean, this thing that they think is rather good, you know. I mean, and they sort of buy into it, they find it quite attractive. So in a curious sort of way, you know, when the Iranians say, you know, the English are behind everything. There's a sort of sneaking admiration for it, I have to say. It's not actually all a condemnation. I mean, some of it is, obviously. And there is, and I should be very clear on this, there's a deep, deep disappointment with Britain in the sense that they feel she never lives up to her ideals. So the British come in and they say, you know, we're in favour of constitutional government, we're in favour of the rule of law, we want this, we want that. But then, you know, revolutionaries, even in the constitutional revolution, say when push comes to shove, you never back us. You know, you're always actually siding up with the Russians. You know, I mean, as they did in the First World War and the Second World War, you see. So that's the point. And so there is that element. But my point about the relationship, which is quite interesting, is precisely this, and I've said this in relation to America as well. I said the belief that the British have betrayed the Iranians is founded on the fact that, you know, their expectations of Britain were higher. Do you see what I mean? I mean, the betrayal is predicated on the fact that in some way they consider them each other friends. And they felt they were let down by the British. But it's because there was something that the British could let them down over. Nobody felt betrayed by the Russians because nobody actually assumed the Russians were going to do anything. I mean, so there is that element there, which I think is very interesting. It sort of partly explains, by the way, that despite, as you say, your relatives or any Iranian you talk to will tell you, you know, the British do this, the British do that. At the end of the day, the number one destination for many of these people whinging about, you know, whatever Britain is, Britain. And they want to come to America and they want to come to Britain and they want to go to university and they want to have them, you know, their medical treatment here and this, that, and the other. So, you know, like I say to people, there are very few Iranians I know who want to go to Russia, you know, ever. I mean, not just now. I mean, ever. Nobody wants to go to Russia. Nobody wants to go to China, you know, but they all want to come to the West. So why is that? Well, it betrays an underlying admiration, I think, a sort of a mutual, almost a reluctant respect. But there is one there. And it reflects the fact that I think when you look at it, the British could connect to the Iranians in a way that other people couldn't, because they were coming from within one part of the Persianate world.
Yeah, I think, yeah. And I guess successive British governments are letting down Iran because of short-term political requirements.
Well, I mean, so the classic case of the Constitutional Revolution, which I think is the biggest blunder in British foreign policy, as far as Iran is concerned. There are many to choose from, as you know. But as far as Iran is concerned, you know, you have a Constitutional Revolution. The British ambassador in Tehran by the end of 1906, 1907 is a gentleman, very interesting chap called Cecil Spring Rice. And for your listeners, just to let you know, Cecil Spring Rice is the author of the hymn "I Vow to Thee, My Country." In his spare time, he writes quite good hymns, you know. And Cecil Spring Rice actually says to Edward Grey, who's the foreign secretary, the liberal foreign secretary, rather, Edward Grey is preoccupied with the defence of the motherland against the rising power of Germany. I mean, you're quite understandable, okay? But almost before the Constitutional Revolution has got going, Edward Brown is fixated on the fact of getting some sort of alliance set up in Europe to prevent, you know, the German threat or to contain the German threat. And he's persuaded really by the French, you know, to sign up to a secret agreement that they will support the French in any attack. But of course, the French are allied with the Russians. So the French are very keen to ensure that this settlement includes some sort of rapprochement with the Russians. Now, the Russians are completely antithetical to the Constitutional Revolution in Iran. They hate it. They want to crush it. And yet in 1907, Grey, because of his preoccupation with Europe, signs the Anglo-Russian Convention with Russia, in which all of Britain's border disputes in Asia are settled with Russia. And there's an agreement that Iran will be divided into spheres of influence. And I emphasize these are spheres of influence. It's not territorial partition, but nonetheless spheres of influence, in which Russia has, as her sphere of influence, the whole of northern Iran. I mean, you know, it's probably one of the worst, I have to say, agreements. And interestingly enough, Curzon, among all, you know, who's the conservative, you know, is railing against it. I mean, he's completely this lunatic idea, you know. He's like, what on earth are you giving the Russians, you know, freedom to roam in northern Iran? Because basically that's where all the revolutionary activity is going on. The British, meanwhile, save for themselves, you know, this sort of southeast corner of Balochistan, ostensibly as a border, you know, a buffer zone with British India. Although I have to say, the government in Delhi thinks this is madness. I mean, what are you doing? You know, I mean, and you know, Cecil Spring writes to Grey, and he says, "We will be seen as having betrayed our Persian friends." And of course, Edward Brown, who was the very prominent Persianist at Cambridge at the time, gets one of the revolutionaries, a gentleman by the name of Taghizadeh, to come to England to play on English public opinion, you know, and say, look, you've got to help us. And Taghizadeh and another colleague writes a very, very powerful polemic, I have to say, very, very interesting, called An Appeal to England. And he says in this document, he outlines all the stuff about Russia. And he emphasized in three separate places in like a four-page or five-page appeal, he says, in a very special sense, the constitutional revolution is the spiritual child of Great Britain. And you guys need to step, basically, you need to step up and support us. And he makes the wonderful point. He says, we're not asking you to intervene in Iran. We're asking you to stop the Russians intervening in Iran. And I think it's a wonderful way of putting it, you see. And I mean, you can see this again when you look at, you know, activities today, Syria or, you know, Ukraine and others. I mean, basically, the question is when does non-interference and non-intervention become a form of intervention? Because if the British were not willing to intervene, the Russians had no such qualms and, you know, just went for it. And basically, you know, the constitutionalists were very, very bitter that Britain had turned its back, particularly because the British had played such a pivotal role in the success of the revolution in the first place.
Well, depressingly, I suppose, this behaviour continues. But in the wake of the Second World War and the Labour government, which, of course, is itself committed to nationalism, and it's very interesting reading the quote in the book
about nationalisation, I should say.
So, nationalisation, yes. Yeah. Yes, I should have. Yeah.
Although they were quite nationalistic. I mean, far more nationalistic than current Labour governments, I think. But
and reading Bevan talking about, you know, nationalising industry, we can hardly complain or object to Iran wanting to do the same.
And what is remarkable about that thing, it's very interesting. I found that in a... So the Foreign Office, the Crown Office, published for the first time. It was released in 2017, actually, but it's the official history of the...
As Abadan. Late as that? Wow.
Yeah, yeah. It's the official history of the Abadan oil crisis. And it actually ends in 51, okay? So it doesn't get to the... It avoids it. But mind you, I mean, any historian worth his salt can read between the lines and you can see where things are going. I mean, it's a very, very interesting text. It's the official history. It was written by the official historian of the Foreign Office, a gentleman by the name of Rowan Butler, who's a Fellow of All Souls. And it's a wonderful text, actually. I mean, it's really spectacularly well written, full of criticisms, I have to say. I mean, full of quite damning criticisms, particularly in the appendices where you get various Foreign Office bigwigs coming in and, you know, making very pointed criticism of the way the British carried on. Not just the government, by the way, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company in particular. But pivotal about Bevan's comment, which I think is a striking comment, is he makes this comment in 1946. I mean, think that's 5 years before the crisis. So, you know, you have to conclude that the discussion about nationalization and stuff was going on in Iran as early as that. Now, why was it going on in 1946 and whatever? It was really in the aftermath of an attempt by Stalin to secure an oil concession in the north, which I won't go into details here, but was basically, you know, the Iranians with the American help or whatever outmaneuvered and got Stalin out. But the problem was, like with all these things, having managed to outmaneuver the Soviet bear, Iranian nationalists and activists were saying, bloody hell, you know, if we do it to the Soviets, why don't we turn our attention south and have a look at this concession in the south, you know? And Bevan, I think, was very astute and very prescient in realizing that the agreement, the concession that had been renegotiated and signed again in 1933, which in a pre-war situation, pre-Second World War situation, might have seemed very valid and fair. And I mean, obviously people criticized it, but, you know, workable. Let's call it workable, okay? In the post-war situation, it was just simply not workable anymore. I mean, you know, the international situation had changed. And if you look at Rowan Butler's official history, he says that very clearly. I mean, he says we had an agreement in 1933, which wasn't a bad agreement all round. I mean, I think Iranian nationalists were a bit annoyed that they didn't get the sort of deal they wanted. But I think within the terms of reference and the time period we're looking at, it wasn't as bad as some of the critics say.
How long was the concession intended
to last? So that would have gone on till the 1933. So the first concession was signed in 1901. And it has to be said, it was a pretty poor negotiation. I mean, the Iranians completely bungled it. But why did they bungle it? Because nobody had any understanding what an oil industry was. I mean, nobody had. They just thought they were selling caviar or something. You know, here's the concession to, you know, sell whatever for 40 years. And so they signed a very, I mean, if you read the agreement, it's quite clear that whoever negotiated on the behalf of the Iranians didn't really know what was going on here. Because, of course, you know, for them, you have to understand that, you know, an industry like an oil industry, it's, you know, by the 40s and 50s, it's not simply a question of taking oil out of the ground. It's all the derivatives that come from it, you know. And of course, in 1901, nobody had any idea what this is going to be. And you have to remember also that the oil, and this is coterminous, obviously, with the Constitutional Revolution, by the way. I mean, it's these, the 1900 to 1910 is a phenomenal period in Iranian history, I have to say, for different reasons. But, and both of which, by the way, the British are involved. Okay, so it's quite striking. But it takes 7 years for them to find oil. I mean, this is the strike. I mean, the problem with the history of the Anglo-Iran Oil Company is we all look at it from the perspective of, you know, with the benefit of hindsight. But if you're looking at it from...
Yeah, so the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company is exploiting Iran throughout the entire period, whereas they've putting it, there's expenditure, quite a lot of expenditure in the early years.
Huge, huge amount. Yeah. And what you're getting is basically the concession in the early years is basically bought for £40,000 in total, which is... I mean, it's not pittance, but it's not massive either, but it's a sort of standard. But then it takes them, but I think Knox Darcy, the Australian-British entrepreneur, spends another, I can't remember now, so but I think £200,000, £250,000 trying to find oil. So it's a lot of money. And basically, he's bankrupt and he sells to Burma Oil. Burma Oil comes in and takes a share. And so basically, when they finally strike oil in 1908, it's Burma Oil that's, you know, running the show. But, you know, then it takes several years for really... the industry to grow. A critical moment, of course, is in the eve of the First World War. Churchill, as First Lord of the Admiralty, buys a golden share in the company because he considers it a strategic asset because the Royal Navy is moving from coal to oil. But let me caveat two things there, because again, it's part of this mythology that goes about. First of all, everyone sort of assumes that Churchill knew the First World War was about to break out. You know, everyone sort of says, on the eve of the First World War, Churchill did this very canny move. Well, obviously, I mean, the point is that they, you know, Churchill thought he was about to fight a war in Ireland. He didn't think he was about, you know, I mean, this thing, it's not that sort of prescient. But the other thing is really to do with the golden share. And again, this goes to the heart of, you know, British political economy and political economic thought at the time. The assumption is with the golden share that the British government owned a proprietary, you know, basically it became a state company. But in actual fact, such was the dominant theories of economics at the time that everyone was horrified at the notion that this should be a state company. And so basically the golden share had very, very specific limitations onto it. And really it was about ensuring that Anglo-Persian, as it was then, could not be sold to a foreign buyer. I mean, this was the principal thing, that the government could intervene if there was a strategic threat. You know, this was a strategic asset we need to keep. But they were not allowed, almost by parliamentary, by act of parliament, they were not allowed to interfere in the day-to-day running of the company. I mean, that was the difference. It's not like they had a controlling influence in that respect, and they wouldn't have wanted it. The other thing that the company did, of course, which the Iranians were unhappy with, and I think quite justifiably, is, of course, the company came to an arrangement. This was part of the deal, of course, to supply the Royal Navy on a sort of a discounted basis. So the Royal Navy got access to oil on a cheaper basis than almost anyone else. But other aspects of the company, really, about them paying more to the exchequer in London than the Iranians got in royalties, that's a bit of a... I mean, the only reason that happened, really, and it happened quite late, is because in the run-up to the Second World War, certainly 38, 39, whatever, corporation tax went through the roof. So the company was paying much more. I mean, clearly it was. And it had become a much more sophisticated beast by then. So it was paying dividends here and this, that, and the other. And of course, the Iranians were completely oblivious. I mean, they didn't understand. They couldn't work out why this was happening. But that is true. I mean, there was a problem there. And clearly after the Second World War, the way forward would have been a 50-50 agreement. I mean, this was the way forward. And, you know, even Bevan, who's saying, you know, we can't stop the nationalizing it, we're doing it, to be honest. I mean, really what they're saying is, you know, that the ideal agreement would have been a 50-50 agreement, which is what other countries were doing. But the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company by this stage had become so legalistic and fixed in its sort of rather fuddy-duddy, had a dreadful director, I say, William Fraser, who was very, very archaic in his approach. He didn't, he wasn't, you know, what's fascinating about it, and I'm not sure if I put this in the book, but I may have done, is that, you know, when Fraser was appointed in 1941, I believe, the Foreign Office objected to his appointment. I mean, they said, why are you appointing someone who has no background in Iran at all? I mean, you know, what they were basically saying is, we've appointed a technocrat to a job that's basically a political job, you know, and this is going to lead to disaster.
But if they've appointed him, I mean, one would assume, therefore, there's some kind of influence at the very least over...
No, I mean, the Foreign Office objected to it, so but they couldn't stop his appointment. I mean, he was appointed by the Board of Directors. They also then said that, you know, he should at least surround himself by experts on Iran, and he didn't.
Which he didn't, right.
So you find a very fractious relationship between the Foreign Office and the Board of Anglo-Iran. But this is a standard motif with Britain and her companies throughout the 19th and 20th century. What happens is they get very frustrated with these companies. It's the same with the British Imperial Bank of Persia, by the way, but that ends in a much less fancy, much less rambunctious way. They have a very fractious relationship. And then it all hits the fan and the government basically feels it has to back the cup. Do you know what I mean? I mean, oh, well, now we've hit a crisis. We better come to their assistance. Bevin's comment was very important in the sense that it points out that they knew that this was not going to work.
And so in the build-up to the coup, so we're about 1950, I was very interested. We didn't get to, and I don't want to talk too long about General Ali Razmara.
Yeah, well, he's an interesting figure, though.
Yes. And why is that?
So I think Razmara is interesting.
Just for the benefit of listeners, he's the prime minister prior to Mossadegh.
Well, right, and there was one after him as well. So what happens is Razmara is the chief of the general staff. He's from a very traditional background. He helps in the reabsorption of Azerbaijan after the Azerbaijan crisis of 1946. He's then brought in as prime minister and he resigns his commission. He sits as a civilian. I mean, he's very interesting in this respect. He has, in my view, some very interesting ideas about government in Iran. And he argues quite strongly for things like devolution and a certain amount of decentralization of power. He thinks power is far too centralized, that the regions need a little bit more autonomy. And I think it's an idea just generally that hasn't been discussed enough in Iran. I mean, you know. Anyway, Razmara basically is the guy who manages, through, I don't know, gritted teeth, he sort of gets William Fraser to concede to a 50-50 agreement. And I think the 50-50 agreement is basically the result of pressure, not only from, you know, Iranian negotiators, but also I suspect the HMG and others said, look, you know, for goodness sake, you know. Anyway, the company, after much, much pushing and whatever, finally relents. Razmara then has this agreement and he's very pleased about it, but he doesn't talk about it. He doesn't mention it. But some of his opponents in the political spectrum, you know, in Iran, particularly from National Front and others, hear about this. And what happens is 3 or 4 days before he's about to present it in the parliament, he goes to a wake or something, a memorial for a cleric in a mosque, and he's murdered. I mean, he's basically assassinated in the mosque. And this is a fiasco, because obviously the 50-50 agreement is never, nobody divulges it, he never gets it to parliament. There's huge shock and outrage among a number of parliamentarians. But I have to say, the probably even more shocking in some ways is the number of people who cheer it on. I mean, oh, it's marvellous. We got rid of the traitor, they say, which is pretty shocking stuff, I have to say. And I mean, if you were a British observer, any observer, you'd sort of think, crikey, politics in this country isn't doing very well, you know, when the assassination of your rival is cheered. But the problem is, of course, is that after that, nobody wants to be prime minister. I mean, everyone says, well, not my scene. And the Shah appoints someone else, and he lasts for about 3 months, and he doesn't get very far either. And eventually, Parliament, who's utterly fed up with the whole thing, and the thing you have to bear in mind is there's this view, obviously, that, you know, Mossad there was the popularly elected, democratically elected. Well, he is popularly elected from Tehran as a parliamentarian, but he wasn't democratically elected as prime minister, right? And actually, the National Front caucus in Parliament was quite small. I mean, most of the deputies were not, you know, associated necessarily with the National Front or its ambitions. What the National Front had was control of the oil subcommittee of the Majlis, and they were very keen on nationalization, and he moved very quickly on that. So basically what happens is that Parliament, in a sort of almost like a fit of pique or something, says to the Shah, well, why don't you give it to Mossadegh? Because after all, you know, he's been pushing for this for so long, let him bloody clear up this mess, you know. And of course, the Shah, with a certain amount of trepidation and reluctance, will go, oh, all right, then we'll offer it to Mossadegh, on the assumption that Mossadegh is going to turn it down, because they sort of say, well, he's old, he's not really up for it and all that. Of course, he accepts. So then Mossadegh comes in, and that starts this whole process. The nationalization goes through, and then we get into the unfortunately inexorable march towards the crisis in 1953. Now, tied, and I did this in an article I wrote, I mean, tied to Bevin's comment in 46, at the end of 1951, Mossadegh gives a speech in Parliament, and it's a very interesting, and it's on the record, by the way, and it's very interesting. And he says,
yes, this is fascinating.
Yeah. He says, and I sort of see it as quite melancholic, actually. And he says, it's a shame we have reached, you know, basically this crisis, and we don't know a way out. He said, it's a great pity that the British didn't make us an offer of 50-50 a bit earlier, because had they done so, we could have avoided this crisis altogether. Now, this really shocks a number of his allies, because they say, well, hang on, we thought nationalisation was a point of principle. I mean, what do you mean? If we... But it also highlights to me, again, what I was saying right at the beginning, that Mossadegh was not a sort of a, you know, blood and soil nationalist, determined to overturn the anger. He saw it as a mean, he wanted to change the terms of the relationship and the terms of the friendship, if you will. He wanted, obviously, to bring better results for Iran. He wanted, and for him, this was all part of a performance. It wasn't a principle in that sense. His principles were something else. They were about constitutionalism, in my view. And, you know, of course, by the end of 51, you can almost see in his, I think you can read between the lines in his speech, that he sort of feels that we have gone down this route, and I'm not quite sure how we're going to extricate ourselves from it, you know, because he hadn't really anticipated the British reaction. But it's, you know, to my mind, it shows a certain degree of naivety on his part. Now, let me say this. I think the British are right in this, that the Americans probably encouraged him, okay? And why, you know, we have this view that the Anglo-American alliance is tight. Not really. The Americans had their own interests, and they were quite keen to realize them. And you see, the importance of Anglo-Iran and oil and the Abadan oil refinery was it allowed Britain to buy oil in pounds, sterling. They didn't have to buy dollars to buy the oil. Do you see what I mean? Now, post-war Britain, this was absolutely vital. Yeah. And of course, what the Americans wanted was to end that sort of like exception to the rule where oil was basically purchased in dollars and everyone had to buy dollars. It was a sort of the petrodollar, if you will. And, you know, that when you look at the end, the coup, which basically, by the way, although it was planned and drawn up in many ways by the British, and incidentally, it was a contingency planning under the Attlee government. It wasn't a Conservative government thing, but obviously implemented. Eden was the man who oversaw it for the Conservative government. But effectively, it was operationalized by the Americans. I mean, it was the Americans in 53 who basically put it into action. And if you look at the beneficiaries of the coup, actually, to be honest, the chief beneficiaries of the coup are the Americans. I mean, it's not the British. The British lose out quite a bit. They lose their monopoly. They lose their access to oil at sort of favorable rates themselves. And it's another, you know, nail in the coffin of the British Empire in that sense. But the Iranians don't come out well from it at all. I mean, it's not a result for him.
But I'm just interested about the support or lack of that Mossadegh had at the time internally. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the National Front Caucus, of which he was the leader, was a smaller proportion. Did he have support from the bazaar, from the...
No, he did. I mean, basically, you know, once
National Front a popular
goes
leader.
Through, it is popular. No. And I mean, one could even say he's populist. I mean, this is the problem. And why I think he's quite melancholy about that is because, again, I see him as, strictly speaking, a constitutionalist. And while I think all politicians have a certain sort of like, you know, they like the intoxication of the crowd chanting your name and all this sort of thing, I think at the end of the day, I think he found the crowd quite difficult, if I can put it that way. I mean, he wasn't a natural, you know, I have a colleague here who writes about my colleague here, Siavush Ranjivadhami, and he says that, and I think he's right, actually, on this. I mean, he says that, you know, Mossadegh didn't do street politics very well. And, you know, we can debate why that is. I think it's because basically he's a constitutionalist. I mean, he's an old school Qajar aristocrat. You know,
exactly. He's an aristocrat, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, you know, he likes the adulation of the crowd. It's wonderful, whatever. But, you know, the problem with this is you become trapped by it, don't you? He wasn't really master of it. And of course, the two elements that of his support that produced these crowds, one was from the left, the third way, really, by a gentleman called Khalil Maliki.
And when you say left, you mean communists?
Not these, not yet. No, these were basically what you'd call socialists. Communists come in later, really. I mean, the Two-Day Party, the Communist Party, was there too, but they become more of a presence a bit later. And then the other one, of course, is the religious element led by Ayatollah Kashani. Now, the problem is, as the crisis continues, the politics become even more febrile and the economics start to go down the pan, you know, because they can't sell oil and this sort of thing. Mossadegh then resorts to basically ruling by diktat. And this is the great tragedy of Mossadegh, of course, is what he does is, in order to make things work, he almost becomes, you know, dictator. And I mean that in a Roman sense. You know, we got a crisis, I'm going to take exceptional powers. What he does, he basically dissolves the Majlis himself. He dissolves parliament and he rules by decree. Now, of course, this is a major blow to people who say, well, hang on a minute, you know, you're meant to be the constitutionalist. I mean, you're meant to be governing that. So what happens is that the socialists and the religious groups, they basically break away from him. They say, we don't want anything to do with this. They're gone. And as a consequence, he then relies increasingly on the communists who come. And this is what sparks the fear, of course, in the Americans. They go, oh, you know, hang on a minute, this is not looking very good. And of course, because his reliance is on the Two-Day Party and the Communists, Mossadegh then clearly has to tailor some of his language and whatever to sort of like, and the real fear, and people say, oh, well, this is vastly exaggerated, but it's not really, when you think about the Korean War that's going on, or the McCarthyite, you know, paranoia that's going on in Washington, but the, you know, the Cold War element was this idea that
the Soviets.
Yeah, the problem was not so much that Mossadegh was a communist. The problem they felt was Mossadegh could so weaken Iran that there could be a communist coup who would then invite in the Soviet. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah,
that was their fear. Now, you know, you can say that was misplaced and whatever, but I don't think it's an illegitimate fear, actually. I mean, I think it was a very real one when you look in the context of the Korean War and other things that were going on. And this is what undermined him. I mean, I think Mossadegh is a very tragic figure in this respect. I mean, a very tragic figure that he effectively undermines himself. And because ultimately he's not a street fighter in that sense, and never pretended to be a street fighter, when it came to that crucial moment in the coup in August 1953, you know, he basically bungled it. I mean, effectively, I mean, what were you to do? I mean, the danger would have been that you might have had some very serious civil strife, because while I see, you know, I think there are three elements to the coup. There's the Anglo-Americans. There's Mossadegh himself in terms of how he operates and doesn't. But then, of course, there are the Iranians. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, the Iranians always like, it's nothing to do with us. You know, in a very simple way, I say, yes, the Americans bribe people. But there were people in Iran who accepted the bribe. I mean, you know, I mean, you've got to look at it in a slightly more complex. And I think in some ways also people were very anxious about where Mossadegh was leading the country and rallied around the institution of the monarchy. I mean, that's basically what they did. But my emphasis there is it's the institution of the monarchy. It's not the monarch.
No.
People didn't have tremendous affection, not affection, but they have tremendous respect for Mohammad Reza Shah. They thought he was a bit of a dilettante, but the institution of the monarchy was different.
And he's someone we've not really mentioned. And look, we're coming to the end.
But hopefully it's a nice teaser for the book.
Exactly. I would encourage listeners to get the book. I really would. And the Shah, who is, he doesn't do much during this coup, but though that inaction is quite important.
Well, he does. He eventually signs the dismissal. I mean, the coup is basically predicated on this notion. The Shah can dismiss his prime minister. But, you know...
He went on holiday, didn't he? And then he returned... Yes, so...
Well, no, he signed the decree. I mean, under great pressure, it has to be said.
Right.
I mean,
his sister pressurised him, didn't she?
That's right. His sister and also his wife, I think. You know, be a man. so he signs this. And then, of course, there's an attempt at the coup. It appears to have failed because Mossadegh dismisses the... nonsense. And the Shah, in a sort of like panic, sort of gets on a plane and buggers off. Now, interestingly, the Shah departing in some ways creates the space for a second go. Because on the one hand, there are people who are panicking and saying, oh, my God, the monarchy's about to collapse. You know, we need to save it. But also the American agents on the ground, Kermit Roosevelt in particular, then decide to take matters into their own hands and have another go at the coup. And obviously it succeeds, you know, within a week and the Shah's back.
Well, just before we finish this then, I know the Shah doesn't come out of the book too well. But he reigns for in total 37 odd years.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
That's quite a long time.
And rules for a good deal of it, to be honest.
Right.
I mean, I don't think he comes out badly out of the book. I mean, I think there were tremendous achievements of the late Pahlavi period. But the fundamental flaw of Mohammad Reza Shah's reign is he failed to match the economic reforms he put in with political reforms. And because the political framework isn't there, when the economy grew at exponential rates in the 70s, largely because of oil income was increasing, there was no political, straitjacket is too strong a term, but sort of a rule of law framework, if you will, to contain some of this, to regulate this. So what you get with massive injections of liquidity in the Iranian economy in the 1970s is inflation and corruption. I mean, that's basically, you know, it just runs riot. And the system breaks down because it's wholly dependent on him. So, you know, this is the problem. The Shah should have, at the height of his powers, really in the early 70s, moved in a very emphatic way towards a democratic settlement for the country, and he didn't, which is again another tragedy.
Well, this has been fantastic. Thank you. And so for listeners, particularly listeners in Iran, can email me with their angry thoughts or their strong agreement. And I've put that in the show notes. Ali, this has been really wonderful. Thank you very much. And best of luck with the book.
Thank you very much. Wonderful to speak to you.
Thank you for listening. Please do get in touch. Links are in the show notes, especially to any Iranians listening. I'm desperate to hear from you guys. But until then, thank you and good night.